Hello, podcast listeners. We know podcasts are a great way to catch up on a program that you may have missed on KSJE, and it's provided as a free service of this radio station. But you know, KSJE is now listener-supported, and so while you enjoy this podcast, we hope that you'll also take some time to join KSJE. Become a member today. It's quite easy to do. Just go to our website at ksje.com/support and pick the level of support that best matches your budget. Thanks again for listening. Here's your podcast. And back in Studio A this morning, again with my guest, local archaeologist Paul Reed is back with us this morning. Of course, he is joining us from his home this morning, and I can imagine it's probably colder where you are than it is here in town. Paul Reed, am I right?
Yeah. Good morning, Scott. You definitely are right.
Okay.
I think fall came. Sorry. Fall has descended upon us. It was such a beautiful fall, September and October. But I think old man winter is knocking.
I think he is. He's really pounding at the door, I think, at the moment. It's gotten really cold really fast, but that's okay. We enjoy the change of seasons, and our topic this morning is really interesting to me. I know we've talked about it in the past, but I think there's some new evidence, some new studies that are being published about these footprints, right, that have been found here in New Mexico down at White Sands that really kind of help us maybe pinpoint more accurately, maybe a date of humans in North America. Is that my correct interpretation?
Right, Scott. So I was on with you a couple years ago when the researchers working down at White Sands National Park had reported on some footprints that they had dated between 21,000 and 23,000 years ago. So yeah, several thousand, 5,000+ years earlier. And really even the earliest dates that archaeologists and other researchers think are, you know, are well supported for North America and for the West. So yeah, this is pretty exciting. And they've revisited now those footprints and done some additional work and dating. So I think this is really exciting. And I think they've done a great job supporting it at this point.
And as we all know, you have taught us that that is part of your work and your colleagues' work, right, is to put these things out and support them. And then, of course, it gets kind of picked apart by others to just see if it stands up to scrutiny. And this one, you think, does have the data behind it.
Well, right. What they did initially is they did radiocarbon dating on seeds that were in association with the footprints. And they got the dates between 21,000 and 23,000. And they, you know, people reacted to that. I think they got some pushback. They got some questions. So what they did is they went back. And of course, they had done a good job with the excavation. So they had pollen that they had collected from those exact same contexts. And what they did with the pollen is they did radiocarbon dating on the pollen. And this was terrestrial pollen. The seeds that they had dated before were actually from a lacustrine, or what we'd call a lake deposit. So they went back and got land-based pollen in the same context, dated that. And then they tried a method that's been around for a few years, but is also very effective. It's called optically stimulated luminescence, or OSL. Saves us the mouthful.
Yeah.
And this is used to date sort of the exposure of, in this case, quartz grains in the exact sediments that were within those footprints. Criticisms that came up, the question was, okay, well, we know these dates have come back early, but is the plant material really well associated with the footprints that we're trying to date? And that's really always kind of a challenge in the archaeological world. If we don't get direct carbon dates or tree ring dates or other really accurate absolute methods that tie us to whatever the phenomenon is that we're trying to understand. So this is particularly powerful now. We have three different types of dates and footprints in this context, and it's holding at this 21 to 23,000 years ago. So yeah, really exciting.
Interesting. And the article that you shared with me that I'm sharing online is from Science, talking about the headline, New Footprint Dates Bolster Claim That Humans Lived in Americas During Ice Age. Is that kind of the time period that we're talking about?
Right. And what makes this, you know, interesting and controversial is this is when we're, you know, the continent was still in sort of the full blast, if you will, of the last part of the Pleistocene. And, you know, the thought was that it was difficult for folks who were making a migration from Northeast Asia coming across to North America, because during this time it was fully glacial. You know, and then about 5 to 7,000 years after that, there developed what we describe as an ice-free corridor coming down into North America across the Bering Land Bridge, you know, with a lot of the water that's there now tied up in ice, but enough room to, you know, this is a little bit overstated, but squeeze folks through, right, through the ice.
Right.
So this is 5,000 to 7,000 years before that. So, you know, we're definitely looking at some kind of coastal route now, and folks moving down the water, I think, is the accepted idea at this point. And so, yeah, this is very exciting. The other thing is we have no other sites basically in this time period anywhere in North America. So, but then the question is raised: have we been looking in the right areas and looking at the right sediments? Because, you know, when we do archaeological work, the work that I do in different places and other folks do, we're pretty much out on the land, we're walking the landscape, we're looking for any signs of prior human activity. But to find sites this old, unless you have the perfect erosional situation, you're not going to see these easily on the surface. So what we need to be doing, I think, is looking at these 20 plus thousand year old deposits, geology and the geomorphology, and saying, let's look here. And I know this is underway at White Sands National Park, and other teams are also sort of jumping on this. So yeah, pretty neat stuff.
Right. And I guess back at this time then, Paul Reed, to go with the dating that we are learning, obviously New Mexico is not at the current time a coastal region, but was that different this many years ago then? Was there more access to water than we have now?
Well, in this particular area at White Sands, you know, there was a playa or an ancient lake.
Yes.
So folks there, you know, interacting with that had access to those resources. But we're not talking about like the giant inland seas that existed millions of years ago, right, during the age of the dinosaurs and other early creatures on the planet. So we're still really, you know, not that far back, but with so much of the water tied up in glaciated areas, and you know, as far south as where we are, we didn't have what's described as continental glaciers, but what we had were mountain glaciers that covered all of the highest peaks. My window here, just a few miles around Mount Wheeler, and then other high peaks in New Mexico, Colorado, all the mountainous areas of the West had those high elevation glaciers. So that tied up some water. But then we also had a much wetter climate in general. So we had a number of ancient lakes or playas, and that's the particular topographic setting for this finding, was in a dry lake bed where people walked through, left their footprints. You know, we had just the right situation where sediments came in, the prints weren't obscured, they were preserved through time and then found later with the archaeological work.
Right. And that was going to be my next question to you of kind of how these were preserved for so long to be able to be found in modern day. I guess it's the unique geography of the White Sands area, maybe, to have these deposits from so many thousands of years ago to still be preserved. I mean, anyone that's built a sandcastle on the beach knows they don't last very long, but this was a whole different scenario.
Right. And in this case, you know, the environment wasn't quite as active as we get in our modern beaches, you know, with a lot of wave activity, because, right, as you just said, we're not going to get a lot of survival of things there. So it was a pretty stable environment. And this is one reason why studying ancient lake deposits, you know, and playa deposits is really a great place to look for different types of evidence, because it's a pretty placid environment. You know, the wind will kick up, and you know that, you know, they issue warnings when the wind kicks up, there's wave action, but it's pretty moderate by and large. And what we get then in these lake deposits as they dry out through time is really great stratigraphy, as different layers of sediment and soil are laid down, And that's what happened in this case. You know, this group of folks walked through this area, left footprints, and then the situation, you know, the lake dried out to have those be fixed, and then other sediments came in that just created the right depositional environment to preserve them. So yeah, and I think, you know, I couldn't give you great odds, but this, so you know, not very common at all. So again, the thing to do now, and folks are on this, is to look for other playa lake type settings from this 20,000 year interval and see what else might be out there.
Right. And but certainly there have been prints. I'm thinking not maybe human prints, but dinosaur prints and other wet areas like this along creeks and things, obviously dating much earlier. But there has been other things found in these types of wet coastal or lakeside situations, right?
Right, definitely, and some of the most famous ones, you know, over in Africa in an area called Laetoli, there are prints that are, I think, they're 3.1 to 3.2 million years old, and these were Australopithecine, you know, sort of early human ancestors, cousins that walked through a lake bed there, left prints. Again, they were perfectly preserved, and then the well-known paleoanthropologist Mary Lee back went in to study them, and you know, just really a phenomenon. And that, of course, helped for that period of time to understand that those early human ancestors or cousins were fully bipedal because of the way the prints got laid down. Now, of course, what we're talking about here is just modern humans, you know, doing their thing, but you know, equally as exciting for sure.
Right. And we know a little bit of something about this group of people, don't we, that were walking across this sandy surface, right? I mean, it's multiple people, not just one. And maybe were they mostly younger, do we think?
Yeah, different size footprints, young adults, and even some individuals who are more in the you know, the child or kid juvenile range. So definitely a family group, and that's real exciting. Because we don't have any stone or lithic artifacts, we have no other remains that are in association with this. We really don't know a whole lot more about this family. This infer that during this time period, well before agriculture, really anywhere in the world, they made their living by gathering plant foods and hunting, you know, probably big Pleistocene mammals. What would be really nice in this case, of course, research further is to find some other sites associated with these footprints at the same stratigraphic levels, you know, that would give us tools for, you know, hunting tools, big projectile points, spear points, other stone tools for scraping hides, you know, cutting materials, et cetera. So that's really what we need to sort of round out what we know about, you know, just this real sort of tantalizing bit of information about these folks.
Right. And as you mentioned, though, there is a lot of work being done, I guess, in and around this area or in other similar areas to try to find just what you described.
Right. I wouldn't say a ton of work, but
Okay.
folks
Some.
are definitely interested at this point. And yeah, trying to kind of rethink some assumptions.
And with this new timeline, Paul Reed, you mentioned, you and we and all of us have been talking about you more talking to me about it, that, we say that humans arrived in North America again from Northeast Asia and kind of traveled down the coastal areas along the Pacific coast, if I remember our conversations correctly, and then, came through this area on their way into Central America and on into South America. Is that still kind of the progression, correct?
You know, I think there's tantalizing possibilities about folks crossing bigger stretches of ocean, you know, in boats, small boats at the time, but we don't really have what I would consider really good solid evidence for like folks coming over from, say, Polynesia, Hawaii, that area, you know, 3,000 miles across the ocean. But in other parts of the world, you know, we definitely have evidence of those kinds of journeys. But yeah, so in this case, we're you know, folks think it's a coastal adaptation, kind of going up and down the coast, finding areas, especially to the south, you know, because we're not as I mentioned, we didn't really have continental glaciers covering big chunks of the land, really much below sort of the Dakotas, going across towards Minnesota into New England, and then coming across and the current state of Washington. Some evidence of those continental glaciers pushing a little south. So if they made it as far south as current day Washington, Oregon, then they would have had the ability to, continue their adaptation with the coastal, shellfish, fish resources, and then push inland, to look for other plants and animals as part of their sort of normal migration. The other point I want to emphasize is, we're looking at this from 2023, through a lens into the past, and we do consider it a migration and a movement of people, but this wasn't necessarily folks saying, "Hey, we want to go over there. This is a great place to, we're going to be the founding populations in the Western Hemisphere, et cetera." And that may be kind of an obvious point, but when we talk about migrations, in the historic period, migrations oftentimes were a very deliberate act, right? We're going to leave. We're seeking better conditions. We're going to go over here. We don't have any information to suggest that's what happened. It certainly could have happened, but more likely, family groups were, doing their normal rounds of plants and animals and fishing, and then, moved into new areas and maybe thought, "Hey, this is nice. We're south of the ice, In this case, they may have been fairly pleased and happy to get south of those giant continental ice sheets.
Right, certainly. And maybe following the food, I would expect too, right? If that was their main reason for being, right? And there were no really organized villages or things like that. It was really mostly family groups. Isn't that what we know or think we know?
Right. At this point, we don't see evidence of a whole lot of folks living together in any one spot. And again, with so far anyway, the absence of sites in this time period, my inference is that we're talking about a very, very small population numbering, hundreds or low thousands at the very most. And which stands in real contrast to what we talk about later in time, which is this widespread Clovis phenomenon starting around 13,000 and a half years ago, where we see those sites, with the very distinctive fluted projectile points that we call Clovis points, named after Clovis, New Mexico, where they were found, almost 100 years ago now. But the Clovis horizon is all over North America and extending to the South and Central and South America almost instantaneously. And I think as we've talked on prior shows, Scott, this is one of the reasons that, to me anyway, and to other archaeologists and researchers, it makes sense that we have, so-called pre-Clovis peoples in the area, because otherwise we really don't have a great basis for understanding why all of a sudden there's all these people all over the continent, So at the 21 to 23,000 year range, again, that's a lot earlier. So, but that's why we're doing this work.
Right. But and I guess this helps maybe fill in the blanks a little bit then of that previous narrative, if you will, with the data that has been presented here. And of course, as you mentioned at the beginning of our conversation, it looks pretty solid. And it looks like we may have lost Paul Reed here for just a moment. So we'll see if we can't get him back. There he is. Did you hear
Yeah,
that?
sorry.
That's okay. Did you hear
A
that
little bit of
question?
internet instability. No, please repeat, Scott. I caught the first part,
That's
but
all right. I was just asking you with this new evidence and data that's supporting it, as you have told us, it looks pretty solid. Does this kind of fill in some of the blanks then, I guess, that were there about population growth in North America and these types of trends?
yeah, I think it definitely does, but because again, we know so little about this time period, we've got a whole lot more work and hopefully more sites that are going to fit into this time period or slightly earlier, slightly later, depending upon how it goes, to really sort of draw out and fill in this narrative. We could liken this to the very, very tip of an iceberg, where we're seeing a couple of square feet of material, but there's thousands and thousands more of that, the mass of that iceberg below the surface. So that's kind of what it's like to me. And yeah, I'm almost ready to quit my day job and go looking for 20,000-year-old sediments across the West. Yeah, again, just super exciting. I know I've said that a lot, but this is a revolution, I think, in how we understand this. And one of the interesting things, and in the article that we shared on Science, from Science, my friend at Acoma Pueblo, Kim Charlie, is quoted, and she was quoted 2 years ago saying, "This doesn't surprise us. We have a very deep sense of our time on the continent as indigenous people." And, I think Kim is very kind, but it's kind of like, well, you're archaeologist, it's time for you to catch up. So keep working hard.
Right. Very true. Very true. And you mentioned earlier some of the data that's that's using to support this this article and this idea of the timeline here. And it sounds like there's maybe some newer technology being used to try to help pinpoint the dates a little bit firmer and to stand up to the scrutiny. Is that something also that we're seeing with this article and this evidence?
That's right. Radiocarbon or C14 dating, carbon dating, different names, but that's been around since the 1950s, and it's been refined through time. We can now do what are called accelerator dates on extremely small quantities of material, just a few grams, literally. Folks could think about this as, just a collection of the smallest seeds that might come out of things we eat today, tomatoes, oranges, et cetera. They can date those. And that's great. So we've had real advances there. But in the sort of luminescence dating world, there's a number of different techniques. There's one called thermoluminescence, which will date either rock or pottery in the last time that those items were exposed to the luminescence of the sun, assuming they get sealed and collect sediments, sort of calibrate that. So we had pretty good luck with, we call that TL for thermoluminescence dating, back in the 90s, when I was working on some sites up in the Navajo Reservoir area and a few other areas. But this optically stimulated luminescence, OSL dating, is tied to that as well, with sort of the last time these quartz grains were exposed, took in luminescence, and then were sealed off in a deposit. This can be done on smaller samples than the TL dating and can go further back in time. So these different methods kind of intersect at different points as we look at this timeline of human presence, on the planet. So yeah, I think OSL is has proven in this case to really be quite useful. Now, the article goes through, if folks dig in and read it, other archaeologists from outside the project, outside, the White Sands National Park staff and other researchers, they pulled in, raising questions and saying, well, we'd still like to see more OSL dates. We'd really like to get better dating for this, this, and this. And, I support that additional work as well. I do think, though, and I will say that sometimes with these really early sites that don't fit sort of the long, 100 plus years accumulated body of knowledge in archaeology, I think sometimes there's more scrutiny on, things that sort of push the envelope, if you will. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing, but there are other sites that are much more recent that, I've looked into here and there that sometimes have questionable associations between what was dated and what the archaeologists are talking about. So, rules of scrutiny, I guess, is what I'm suggesting, can vary pretty tremendously across, what people are talking about and what they're researching.
Right. And maybe final question, Paul Reed, but does this timeline then kind of fit into some of our previous conversations about some sites that have been found, maybe, and I'm trying to remember, I think it was maybe coastal Alaska or the Pacific Northwest, that seemed to be really early indications of human habitation in North America? Is that timeline kind of fitting, or is this kind
Well,
of an outlier?
it's these are outline dates, so
Okay.
they're at least 5,000 years earlier than any other site that we have in North America or in the Western Hemisphere that date to this time period. Now, what this does intersect is some of the DNA evidence that we've talked about, which suggests that we've got people up in sort of greater Alaska, Bering Strait, across to Canada, back to the west, to Northeast Asia, in this 20,000 year time period. So that is those fit together pretty well.
Okay.
What we would like is, of course, more sites in this 20,000 year range. And the challenge with coastal archaeology is, you know, we talked about sort of the calm playa lake type deposits and some wave movement for sure. The coasts get hammered through time on our planet through, you know, wave action. And especially if there's glaciers that are potentially intersecting, they melt, the water runs, you know, and it was a very dynamic atmosphere climate during the Pleistocene. So we've had trouble, archaeologists as a whole have had trouble finding those coastal sites really anywhere in North America that might go back that far. So, but I think this will push archaeologists who work in those coastal settings to continue to look and look harder. And then in the interior west, again, I think this is wide open, you know, when folks can really zero in on the 20,000 year horizon, as we would call it, and basically see what's out on the ground and what we can learn. So, yeah, very, very neat stuff.
Right, very true. And of course, you have told us before that this migration, if you will, wasn't just a 2 week thing. This took tens of thousands of years, thousands of years, correct, of that whole movement over that land bridge before it was underwater.
Right. We have movements of people, you know, with these sites, this site being pretty well supported at 21 to 23,000, we have movements of people over, yeah, hundreds, thousands of years now. And, you know, and then kind of leading up again to that Clovis horizon, just great expansion of population in North America. So, yeah, and just waves of people, you know, climate maybe shutting that down at times, population increases, people move on. So, yeah. A very dynamic setting during this time period.
Got you. In a long period of time, too, that we would think.
Right.
Wonderful. Well, Paul, again, very exciting that this discovery is happening in our own state and that New Mexico can play a role in our understanding of human history here on this continent. So thank you for sharing it with us this morning.
Well, my pleasure, Scott. Thanks for having me on, and I look forward to our next visit.
Okay, we'll do it in December. Take care, Paul Reed. Happy Thanksgiving to you and your family
All
coming
right.
up.
Alex, same to you, Scott.
All right. Thank you so much. That's Paul Reed. Of course, he works with Archaeology Southwest. He's done a lot of work with Selman Ruins, Aztec Ruins, Chaco Canyon, and many, many more. He's my regular guest, which I so appreciate his time right here on KSJE. Did you enjoy that podcast? We hope that you did. And if you did, share it with your friends. And if you really want to keep podcasts like this coming, please support KSJE. You can do it easily online at ksje.com.